I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey. And we're the Office Ladies. We're still talking about all the hilarious behind-the-scenes details from The Office with icons from the show like Rainn Wilson, Greg Daniels, Melora Hardin, and so many more.
And we can't forget our two conversations with Office Ladies superfan Billie Eilish.
Hello. So join us for brand new episodes every Wednesday.
And revisit The Office Rewatch every Monday.
Follow and listen to Office Ladies wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday Take. I'm your host, Blois Olson.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
For Sunday, April 20th, 2025, Easter Sunday. I hope you are having a nice morning. And enjoying the day. It is, it's nice to have a little sign of spring, probably maybe not as much as we all wanted, but the rain will help this coming week as well. The legislature was off this past week and, you know, Congress is back in their districts. There's a few things to look forward to this coming week to watch, and to observe. First and foremost is the legislature will come back. And we'll get a real sense, I think, this week of how urgent they are to get done on time. I still don't think there's any way they get done by May 19th, about 4 weeks from now, for that final deadline, when we all know in reality it's June 30th. The other thing to watch this coming week is Angie Craig. She is anticipated to make a decision by the end of the month about running for the U.S. Senate. She has four town halls this week in Minnesota's Republican House districts. She's doing them through her campaign fund, which I think is trying to protect her from scrutiny about using official dollars to do that. I think the pushback from her Republican colleagues in the House will be strong. But that is another piece of the 2026 setup to watch. We don't see a lot of candidates emerging on the Republican side. Royce White and Adam Schwarzy both reported their fundraising numbers last week. Neither one of them was overly impressive. And yet it's still early, but that early momentum, I think, will leave the door open for somebody else if they decide to run. And then this week, we're going to talk to Richard Carlbaum. He's the new chair of the DFL. And, you know, we'll ask him, does he think Governor Walz will run again? He worked for Governor Walz when he was in Congress. He recently left his office and knows Governor Walz and his political instincts and motivations and as well as anyone else. I hope you're having a great Sunday. When we come back, DFL Party Chair Richard Carlbaum will join me on the Sunday Take on Newstalk 830 WCCO. Joining me this week, as I said in the intro, is DFL Chair Richard Carlbaum. He was recently elected, just like when GOP Chair Alex Plekish was elected. We had him on the show, and I'm happy to have Richard join me now. Richard, thanks for joining me on Sunday Take.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Blois.
Congrats on getting elected. As you and I have known each other quite a while, and there was once upon a time in my life that I thought about being a party chair about 30 years ago. And then some people told me it was like one of the crazier ideas I've ever had, which says a lot. But it's not an easy job. It's a job of doing a lot of work, rolling up your sleeves, dealing with factions and personalities at the really ground level of politics with the most passionate advocates who, you know, frankly, never seem to be thinking they're headed in the right direction. What did you see in this job that made you want it? And how's it going so far?
Thank you for the question. You know, first off, folks started approaching me about possibly running for chair of the DFL back in December when people realized that Ken Martin was likely to be elected chair of the Democratic National Committee, which he ultimately was, obviously, on February 1st. And initially, you know, my response was, thanks. I have a great job, best job of my life. No, thank you. I don't need to be chair of the DFL at this time. And that was my consistent response for quite a while. And then as as February 1st drew near and others kept coming and trying to convince me to think about doing it, I had thought that I was in a firm I'm not going to run camp. And then I went for a walk with my spouse and 3 days in a row. And Justin said to me, you know, are you sure you made up your mind? I said, why? He said, well, we've gone on walks 3 days in a row and each time you've brought this up. So I don't think you've actually made up your mind. And so it's those who are closest to you, who know you well, who understand that maybe you need to rethink your decision. So I did. I opened the door and I listened carefully to folks that I trust and I'm close to, people who probably understand the job pretty well, and ultimately decided that I did want to step forward. You know, the moment we're facing right now with a second Trump presidency is one in which Democrats have to be ready to stand up and fight back. There's a lot of chaos and confusion coming out of Washington right now. Every single day, there's a dozen headlines that will raise the blood pressure of everyday working Minnesotans who don't pay attention to politics. And I think that my job as the chair of the Minnesota DFL is to make sure that people feel empowered to respond in this moment. And probably even more important, help sort through all of the headlines to really make sure we remain focused on what we can do in this moment to prevent the worst from happening. How we can, as a party, as a Democratic Party, be in a position to empower people to preserve democracy and stave off devastating budget cuts from the federal government that would leave Minnesotans without health care, would close our rural hospitals, would really devastate everyday hardworking Minnesotans. And so I feel like that's my job. I've been on the job for 3 weeks as of tomorrow. We've been doing a listening tour, and the response has been incredible. 115 people in North Branch showed up. Half the room had never been to a DFL meeting before. More than 50 people in St. Michael. Two-thirds have never been to a DFL meeting before. People are showing up and in these red areas and are really interested in what they can do to be empowered in this moment.
One of the things I want to just rewind back to is who you are and where you're from. I think you identified politics as something you were passionate about from a young age. You ran for a small town mayor job and won at a young age. You rose to an operative level that was impressive. You then worked for Governor Walz after having your own firm. What brought you to politics as a young man? Not to say you're not young still, but you know, we both got a few years in this business. What drove you to be interested or motivated by politics at a young age?
Well, you know, I was an organizer in high school where I got involved in student government and was very passionate about bringing new ideas that the student body would get excited about. Just standard things, you know, in the minds of people, but opportunities to really engage students in an organizing capacity, so much so that the athletic director back in high school referred to me as Senator all the time, which is funny enough. But when I got to St. John's, St. Ben's, I got involved in the College Democrats, and I volunteered for Paul Wellstone. Paul Wellstone would always say, politics is about the improvement of people's lives, and that really was my call to action. That is why I became a Democrat, an active Democrat. I got involved locally to the point where when Larry Hosh, who then was mayor of St. Joseph, Minnesota, ran for the state house in 2004, he looked at me and said, well, if I'm going to do this, you should run for mayor. And I jokingly said, Larry, they never elect me in St. Joseph. I'm gay. And Larry said, it's not that you're gay. It's that you're Lutheran. That's your problem in St. Joe, a very Catholic community. Anyway, I ran and won in 2004. Serving as mayor of St. Joe was a learning experience and something I'm very, very proud of. I learned a lot about people, and I learned a lot about representing people. And I learned a lot about what it means to really invest yourself in community. From there, I went on to be an organizer for the DFL. Ultimately, in 2008, ended up working for then Congressman Walz as his political and finance director, ran his 2010 campaign during the Tea Party wave, where he was the only Democrat to represent a red district to win re-election in Congress that year. It was a really hard year for Democrats, but we won. In 2012, I went on to run the Minnesotans United for All Families, the Vote No campaign that defeated the constitutional amendment that would ban same-sex marriage in the state. Very proud of that. It really changed the trajectory of that issue nationwide. And we saw it obviously legalized here in Minnesota 6 months later. And then ultimately, you know, spent a decade doing things that I love, working on gun violence prevention and working on democracy improvement and doing everything I can to work on issues that I felt passionately about. And then 2 years ago, I was asked to serve as Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Walz in the governor's office. So I returned. Yeah, I would never really leave the Walz fold. Gwen Walz always says the Walz organization is like Hotel California. You can check out, but you never leave. And I definitely have that feeling. So got to serve the people of Minnesota in the Governor Walz administration, which was a great honor. And then when this opportunity came up, as I said, I initially said it wasn't for me, but came to the realization through some soul searching that I might have something to contribute in this moment.
Ken Martin obviously was chair for quite a while, and you never, it's said that you don't necessarily want to be the person who has the job after somebody who's been somewhere a long time and has been very successful. What do you inherit, and what are the challenges with the party right now internally, or, you know, within the various groups that make up the party?
Sure. Great question. You know, so first off, I inherit an incredibly strong state party. When you look across the country and you consider how the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party measures up against other state parties, we are the envy of the nation. We have a financially stable party, an incredibly large donor base that helps us raise the resources needed to fund our programming. You know, we are in such strong financial position that, you know, I committed to organizing early, and we are already in the process of hiring 8 organizers. We'll have them on board soon, and we'll have an organizing director in place. And so we're adding 9 full-time positions to our state party operation in order to organize now. So I'm very grateful that Ken has left behind an incredibly strong base on which to build. We're looking to build forward. You know, we obviously, we're a coalition party by definition. The Democratic Farmer Labor Party came together, I think 81 years ago this week on the 15th was our 81st anniversary. And, what I know about our party is that as a coalition, we can become frayed at times. And so part of my job as party chair is to look internally at where we might be seeing some thin spots in the fabric, if you will. And my job is to do what I can to make sure that we're reinforcing those spots, making sure that people feel heard and seen. As I was seeking this position and talking to Democrats across our ideological spectrum, one of the things that I know is that when I sit down with somebody and I ask them what their perspective is on what our party should focus on, that one question sometimes can lead to a 45-minute listening session where they tell me everything that's on their mind. So it was very powerful, and it was very empowering, actually, both for myself and others. So we have some work to do internally, but we're a big tent, we're a big family, and we're all going to be moving in the same direction in 2026.
I know you've been on this listening tour and hearing folks. I said before we came on the air that, you know, I've been struck by the energy that is anti-Trump or, you know, pro-Democrat. And I think that's the question. Is it anti-Trump or is it pro-Democrat? When you're out in greater Minnesota, which Democrats not so long ago did well in, and frankly have slipped. It's been part of a national trend. While you've gained in other areas, rural areas have been tough for Democrats in Minnesota. How can these issues translate into people's votes changing or getting back to, you know, a more balanced state when it comes to, where the votes come from, for either party?
Yeah. So Democrats have to invest in organizing in greater Minnesota. We have to hire organizers who are from greater Minnesota to actually do community-based organizing in these communities. I think that for a long time, it was efficient and effective for us to organize in the suburbs. And while we made great strides in the suburbs and it led to our trifecta in 2023, I think that we need to understand that a permanent majority in Minnesota for Democrats includes winning in greater Minnesota. And so we're committed to working with our organizing units in greater Minnesota and our candidates in greater Minnesota to make sure that we are hiring organizers who come from those geographic places. And then ultimately, Blaise, I think that Democrats have a reputation for telling voters what to think instead of asking voters how they feel. And we need, as a party, to become listeners. And when we listen to people in greater Minnesota, they're going to talk to us about the economy and the cost of living. They're going to talk to us about their job and their uncertainty about whether their job will exist in 5 years. They're going to talk to us about housing and their concerns around health care. And I got to tell you, Blaise, I think Democrats have delivered in spades when it comes to those issues. And we have a lot to talk about. And frankly, we have the vision for how to rebuild in the rural economy as well. And so for me, it's about making sure that we are, as a party, listening to voters. And one of the things I learned in the 2012 campaign is when you approach a voter more as a conflicted person rather than a persuadable person, you actually have an opportunity to build a relationship through the conversation itself. When you ask questions and you're curious and you listen, those voters will feel heard and seen and valued. And then ultimately that begins to build, maybe even just from the beginning, a small kernel of trust. And upon that trust, you can build understanding and a better relationship. So ultimately, by the time you need to ask for their vote, it's not that they see you as just another transactional politician, but they see you as somebody, as a party that's invested in their community in a way that was a genuine way to understand what it's like to live in their community. And that's what I think our party needs to do. We need to show up relentlessly in greater Minnesota and demonstrate that we're curious about what it's like to live in greater Minnesota, and ultimately demonstrate that that is our ability to represent folks in greater Minnesota.
I'm speaking with Richard Carlbaum. He's the DFL chair. You're listening to Sunday Take on News Talk 830 WCCO. We'll continue this conversation with the two words, conflict and trust, after we come back. 3, 2, 1. We're back on Sunday Take. My guest is Richard Carlbaum, the current DFL chair, longtime organizer in the state of Minnesota. You know, I've seen you do some other interviews, and a couple of weeks ago, it struck me when you said voters are conflicted about Trump. And I thought that was a concise way to talk about the conversations I have across the state or wherever I am in the country. When people look at you and they're just not sure. They're just not sure. What do you think? Why do you think, if people were conflicted about Trump, but yet he won and he made up some ground in Minnesota, and so did Republicans, how does that conflict about Trump or Democrats, how does that evolve? How does that change? What do you think the source of, let's just say, rural voters or moderate voters' conflict is?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, I think the short campaign season that we had, where Kamala Harris was thrust into the top spot on the ticket, didn't give folks enough time to get to know her as a candidate. And ultimately, I think that was the biggest challenge for Democrats to overcome. And so if you imagine yourself as an independent-minded voter, you've seen President Trump be president at one point for 4 years, and you understand, you know, the how he governed and the people he surrounded himself with. And you know that at the end of the presidency, it didn't go so smoothly, but it seems like he's ready to fight for me. As an independent-minded person, he seems like he's ready to give a voice and push for change, and that's what I want. And then you see Kamala Harris, and it's like, I don't quite know who she is. She's been vice president, yes, but I don't know what she really stands for versus Joe Biden. And I think the runway was so small that the independent-minded voters couldn't sort through the decision quick enough and didn't have enough information about Kamala Harris in order to get to the point where they felt good about voting for her. And so I almost think that by default, a lot of folks chose to either vote for Trump or they didn't vote at all, frankly. And then I think in this current time, you have to look at who President Trump is performing as. He is not like the first president. He is not surrounding himself with trusted advisors that are hailed, as, they may be conservative, but, they're folks who have the country's best interests in mind. He is surrounding himself with sycophants who absolutely will cater to everything that he wants. He has surrounded himself when it comes to our economy with people who will and are willing to push it over the cliff. That's just the honest truth, right? I mean, there are people serving in his cabinet who 10 years ago would have said this tariff war is the worst possible thing for our economy. And now, because they want his favor and attention, they're all for it. And their colleagues in the financial sector are scratching their heads going, what happened to these people? They don't recognize it. And so I think what's happening with independent voters right now, Blaise, is that this Trump 2.0 presidency is very different. And the amount of conflict and chaos coming out every single day and the erratic behavior around tariffs and trade and the budget cuts that are coming are making people feel very, very uncertain. And it's our job as Democrats to understand they were conflicted in 2024 before they voted. They're conflicted today. And the best thing we can do as a party is demonstrate that we are the adults in the room. We are the stabilizing force. We are the party that will build back things like USAID so that farmers can make sure that we invest $70 million in our Midwest farm economy and send commodities to developing nations. There are things we as a party can do and stand up that will connect with farmers, connect with independent voters, connect with the working class Minnesotans who couldn't get themselves to vote for Kamala Harris, but in 2026 will absolutely vote Democrat.
One of the other words you use is trust. And I don't want to – we could do a whole show on – the decline of trust in every industry, from media to higher ed to politics to leaders. But, you talk about the short campaign season. Governor Walz. You talk about Trump's inner circle. I mean, there was a massive, massive ruse that Joe Biden was up to the job, and people, the American people's eyes didn't lie when they saw that debate, right? So they saw a debate performance that wasn't good. And then Governor Walz, I mean, I remember it very vividly. He stood outside the White House and said, he's our guy. He's going to be great. And to me, those were some of the moments that the Democratic Party looked like they were in on some sort of other plan as well. And then obviously I had to switch horses. Without going backwards, how do you actually get people to trust in Minnesota that the DFL is really, really focused on mainstream issues rather than the louder voice issues that dominated the trifecta?
Yeah, well, I think that we do so, Blaise, by showing up. And, in these listening sessions, my own experience is informative. I start by asking the question, what are you hearing people talk about? And inevitably, people say, people are talking about the economy and the cost of living. The same $100 doesn't buy the same amount of groceries. People are talking about whether or not their jobs will be there in 5 years and whether or not they'll be, outsourced or automated. People are talking about housing issues right now in our community. Brainerd talked a lot about housing. People are talking about healthcare, and when I was in Winona, people were concerned about the Medicaid cuts that are coming from Congress, and people, and then I stop and I have everyone in the room, mostly who are either Democrats or coming back into the party after a while, and I call attention to the fact that what we hear people talking about are these issues that are core to their ability to live, and as Democrats, we have to be ready to point out that we are the party that passed the largest child tax credit in the country, $2,400 per child this tax filing season in Minnesota. That actually cut poverty by one-third in Minnesota. We are the party that delivers universal school meals, an investment in families of all economic statuses, but more importantly, that's a tax cut for families. And that's a time cut for families. Parents don't have to worry about maybe preparing a cold lunch, and instead they can spend their, in fact, one kid told me, yeah, my mom makes me do homework in the morning now since I have breakfast at school. Kid wasn't very happy about it. And so there's opportunities for us as Democrats to listen to voters. Most importantly, listen to voters. And when they tell us about their most pressing concerns, it's going to be on things like the cost of living, health care, and housing. And those are things that Democrats, I think, have made investments in, and we have a plan to continue investing in those into the future.
That's a good pivot to next year. Next year, 2026, there's a governor's race. There's a U.S. Senate race. Both will be competitive. You're building for that. We're in the legislative session, which Democrats and Republicans are as near of a tie or a deadlock as we're going to see. But you talk about those investments from the trifecta. But there's chances that there's a deficit on the horizon. There are tax increases proposed this time rather than tax cuts last time. What's the theme in 2026? And it can't be we're just against Donald Trump. What would be the theme of the party? And my second follow-up there is statewide candidates in Minnesota, especially for governor, haven't necessarily won the endorsement of the party, which you now have to be, you know, in supportive and in charge of. And does that change next year? Do you just, you see spirited primaries, and how does that help or hurt your party?
Okay. Two dense questions there. We'll unpack them.
I know.
You know, so first and foremost, the message from the Democratic Party in 2026 is very simple. We are going to make sure that you can afford to live your lives and that you have an opportunity, move up. You have upward mobility when it comes to this economy. We're going to make sure that we're building an economy that works for working families. And that means that we are the party that is willing to invest in things like housing, infrastructure, the child tax credit, universal school meals. Although, you know, and also we have $3.5 billion socked away for a rainy day fund. The largest expenditure from the 2023 session was $3.5 billion. Put it in the piggy bank, save it for when we need it. And so that is responsible governing. When it comes to the party endorsement, boys, I am committed to making the party endorsement the strongest possible endorsement, and encouraging candidates to fight vigorously for that endorsement and then ultimately abide by that endorsement. Should we have primary elections, my focus will be to make sure that our endorsed candidate has the support they need to win that primary and ultimately win the general election. I think the candidates who will persevere in our endorsement process will remain hyper-focused on bread and butter issues like how can families better afford their lives? How can we make sure that Minnesotans, working Minnesotans, understand that we are the party of upper mobility, people who can grow into the middle class, in the upper middle class over time. We have a great candidate down in southern Minnesota that just announced this week who tells an amazing story. He's a school teacher with four kids. His name's Jake Johnson. He's challenging Finstead, and there'll be other candidates down there, I know, but I just want to say he tells the story of the Democratic Party, which is grew up extremely poor in Stuartville and now lives a comfortable middle class life with his wife and four kids as a school teacher. That is the definition of our party. I come from the same. I grew up in a very unstable household. My mom moved frequently. I went to 9 different schools by the time I was done with 6th grade. And because of a strong public school system, because of my father, I was able to stabilize my life. And ultimately, I live a very comfortable middle class lifestyle. And so I'm very thankful for the state I grew up in. And people who win our endorsement will focus on those issues that give Minnesotans the best chance of succeeding.
One last question here, Richard, as we just wrap up. You know Governor Wells well. Over or under if he's going to run again?
I think he's going to run again. I think he's going to run. And you know, his achievements, you know, first of all, he governed us through COVID during his first term. And I remember sitting there at the beginning of COVID so many years ago thinking to myself, you know, he had so many great plans for his first term, and they all got upended because we went through that collective experience, and we all were super proud and grateful that we had Governor Walz leading our state, because at the time when Donald Trump was leading the country, you know, he wasn't taking the situation very seriously at all, and it was devastating and people died. His second term delivered for Minnesotans. We have $3.5 billion in our rainy day fund and in our piggy bank because of him. And we have things like universal school meals and the largest child tax credit in the country, a housing investment that is unmatched, and then finally infrastructure, roads and bridges. You know, our highways are being rebuilt, $2.6 billion into roads and bridges in 2023. I think that will propel him into another term, and I think Minnesotans are going to be excited for him to continue governing our state.
I know we'll talk down the road. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Blois.
When we come back, this week's take. We are back on Sunday Take, and before we get to the take this week, here's a message from Minnesota's Hospital Association. Did you know that in one way or another, Medicaid supports all of us in Minnesota? It's the largest source of federal funding for health in Minnesota hospitals, and hospitals rely on this money to keep their doors open. It's a critical program that faces major and unprecedented threats that would strip healthcare from Minnesota's most vulnerable. It would devastate our healthcare system and shift massive cuts and costs to the state of Minnesota. We must protect Medicaid's promise of healthcare access for all Minnesotans, regardless of income, age, or health status. To learn more, visit protectmnpatients.org. Again, learn more at protectmnpatients.org. That's a message from Minnesota's hospitals. You know, this week's take is really something that I know I've talked about a lot, but it strikes me after a week off at the legislature, watching these rallies, watching press conferences in the Oval Office. And when I talk to people who are not in the business or not talking about these things all the time, they use that word that Richard Carlbaum used, conflicted. They're conflicted not necessarily on issues. They're conflicted on something much bigger. They're conflicted on who to trust. This is not just unique to politics, but rather it's a problem in all industries, in all sectors, for all people. Who do you trust and how do you trust them? But the reality is we have to start finding ways to rebuild trust in our leaders. From the governor of the state of Minnesota, the president of the United States, people are conflicted. They don't know who to trust. We've seen a lot of energy in Democrats. We've seen a lot of turnout. We've seen a lot of rallies. And that energy really didn't exist in the fall. And I'm curious, why not? Was Vice President Harris not inspirational? Did Democrats not believe the threat of Trump? What I've said for years is voters are exhausted. And when people are exhausted, they do one of two things. They either blow up or they shut down. So maybe in the fall, Democratic voters shut down a little and that cost them the election. And now they're blowing up. But we also know that exhaustion is no way to live. It's emotional. It's draining. And ultimately, there's a crash. The trust crash is here. It is right in front of us. And so if you're a legislator or a member of Congress or somebody who's around them, anytime they make an excuse for the other side or they won't talk about issues within their party, tell them that's what America expects. It's time to do the unexpected. It's time to look at each of these parties for themselves in the mirror and decide, how and who could I trust in this party going forward? I don't think the answer would be as obvious as many people would think if people put a weigh and aside their partisanship. So as the Minneapolis Police Department encrypts their messages, as Democrats attack Trump for all the ails here in Minnesota, as Republicans don't stand up to Trump or the misinformation, I'm here to tell you that brick by brick, little by little, it is ultimately going to take trust in the people and in the institutions that run our government in order for us to get on in a healthy democracy. That's this week's take. I'm Blois Olson. I'll be with Vanita Monday through Thursday at 6:20. You can follow all of our work at thedailyagenda.com. You can follow healthcare, ag, business, even some good news about Minnesota. So let's make it a great Sunday, because I hope that those people at your table are people you can trust. And now we just have to do the same for democracy.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
And make the table bigger. Until next week, that's the take.
I'm Susie Welch, the host of Becoming You, a podcast where I help you stop living by default and start living by design. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.